Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 30th. Up first is Trevor Toom, writing on why the $34 billion Trans Mountain Pipeline was worth every penny.
The Trans Mountain Pipeline starts shipping in a matter of days. Finally. Canada's West Coast has not seen a new pipeline in over 70 years. But it comes 11 years after the initial application to the National Energy Board, more than 6 years behind schedule, and with staggering cost overruns, rising from an estimate of roughly $5 billion in 2013 to $34 billion today. Was it worth the high price? Whoever or whatever is to blame for the delays and cost overruns, the answer to that question is clear. Yes. And it's not even close. I say this for two main reasons. First, taxpayers are not on the hook in the way that most people think. Indeed, we may not lose any money on the purchase at all. Second, and more importantly, the pipeline's economic benefits to Canada far surpass its cost. Let's start with taxpayers. Many worry that taxpayers will face large losses from owning the pipeline. Recent financial filings paint a very different picture. Oil producers cover some cost overruns with roughly $11 per barrel in tolls, which could cover just over $9 billion in costs, or about 30% of the total. That's high, more than double the project's initial estimate, but far better than the alternative of hauling crude by rail. The cost overruns were also largely covered by debt, which is relevant for at least two reasons. First, any future buyer of the pipeline does not need to pay $34 billion for taxpayers to avert a loss. The buyers would assume these debt obligations instead. Second, and perhaps more importantly, interest on that debt pales in comparison to projected future revenues. Trans Mountain anticipates revenues will soon reach $3 billion and expenses of less than $500 million. Interest on the project's large debt will exceed $1.6 billion, but this still leaves considerable cash available to start repaying debt. Even better, interest costs will gradually fall while revenues and profits rise. The pipeline will be highly profitable for many years. To value the pipeline today, one shouldn't just add up two decades' worth of revenues minus expenses. A dollar tomorrow is worth less than a dollar today. If each year discounts the value of money by, say, 8%, then I estimate the value of projected earnings, before depreciation and interest, over the next 20 years is between $26 billion and $38 billion, depending on the scenario. Some of that will go towards interest and debt repayment, but between $4.2 billion and $8.6 billion is left over. Naturally, these projections have risks. But despite the cost increases, it's not a stretch to see a scenario where this pipeline is worth more than the $4.5 billion that Canada bought it for back in 2018. Today, equity in the project is just under $8 billion and is expected to only grow from here. There are also broader economic benefits for Canada. For oil producers, these benefits are obvious. The 890,000-barrel-per-day pipeline now has a capacity equivalent to over 1,300 railcars of crude oil per day. That's a lot. It will mean lower-cost access to markets abroad, raising producer prices here. There are even benefits for producers who don't directly ship through the new pipeline because the differential between Canada's oil prices and those abroad will shrink. The Canada Energy Regulator, or CER, estimated that having ample pipeline capacity adds about $9 per barrel to what Canadian oil sands producers receive. This adds up quickly with millions of barrels produced daily. Last month, the Bank of Canada predicted a 0.25 percentage point increase in second quarter growth from the new pipeline. That is no small move for a nearly $3 trillion economy. Looking ahead, the gains may be even larger. Over the 25 years between 2016 and 2040, for example, the CER estimated that building no new pipelines would cost Canada's economy nearly $240 billion in today's dollars. Building pipelines avoids these costs. These estimates suggest that the entire cost of the pipeline is more than compensated for by higher GDP after only a few years of operation. Not a bad return. It's not just Alberta that will see a boost. There are benefits throughout the Canadian economy. Research by my University of Calgary colleague Ken McKenzie and co-author Jared Carbone suggests a 10% boost in oil prices increases national economic output by 1%, with benefits for all provinces except New Brunswick. My own estimates confirm this. Of course, updated analysis today may yield different results, but only at the margin. The scale of benefits would remain massive. None of this excuses the project's jaw-dropping cost overruns. Nor should we avoid thorough investigations to ensure future large projects don't suffer a similar fate. There is likely plenty of blame to go around. Policy decisions by several premiers and prime ministers were certainly one factor. Site C and Coastal GasLink construction, starting at around the same time, is another. They unavoidably increased the pipeline's costs by competing for scarce talent and materials. Conditions on the ground also turned out to differ significantly from initial estimates. And of course, COVID-19 didn't help. Despite the sticker shock, the pipeline remains incredibly valuable, both as an individual asset and as a key piece of infrastructure for Canada's economy. The pipeline may have been late and far over budget, but it was worth every penny.
That was a commentary by Trevor Toome. He is a professor of economics at the University of Calgary and a research fellow at the School of Public Policy. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Charlie Buck, writing on why Canadian conservatism's judicial revolution is only gaining strength.
On January 10, 2024, Canada lost a giant in the field of political science, Peter Russell, a longtime professor at the University of Toronto. His illustrious academic career left an enduring mark on my discipline that will be felt for decades to come. Apart from his widely renowned written contributions, Russell helped initiate the growth of a robust and wide-ranging study of Canadian judicial institutions through the many students he supervised. Two of them, Ted Morton and Rainer Knopf, ended up playing leading roles in diversifying the discipline of judicial politics. 24 years ago, Morton and Knopf published The Charter Revolution and The Court Party, a now classic work in Canadian political science that makes the case that the Supreme Court of Canada has become a forum for left-wing interest groups to achieve policy ends they could not accomplish legislatively. A testament to the incisiveness of its heterodox analysis, it is still assigned in graduate-level reading lists. Morton and Knopf were part of a broader intellectual movement of Canadian conservative scholarship. These scholars, Tom Flanagan, Rainer Knopf, Ted Morton, David Berkeson, and Barry Cooper, became known as members of the Calgary School, a loose association of mostly political scientists who, informed by the theories of Friedrich Hayek, Eric Fuglin, Walter Burns, and Leo Strauss, promoted conservative political thought. Alongside Christopher Manfredi, a professor at McGill University, they produced a long list of scholarship that scrutinized some of the most sacred cows of Canadian political life, including the Charter, Quebec's place in the Federation, and Indigenous reconciliation. In the area of judicial politics, Knopf, Morton, and Manfredi, joined by Thomas Bateman of St. Thomas University and another one of Russell's PhD disciples, Janet Hibbert of Queen's University, argued in a series of books and articles that the Supreme Court was excessively activist, expanding rights and freedoms beyond a reasonable interpretation of the text or the original intentions of the Charter's framers. This activism was a cause and effect of the increasing tendency for special interests to frame political discourse in the language of rights. The courts, accepting this conceptual slippage from politics to law, removed vast areas of policy space from democratic deliberation. To members of the Calgary School and other skeptics of judicial review, this judicialization corroded the health of Canadian democracy. It meant fundamental issues like abortion, gay rights, sex work, criminal justice, and religious liberty were decided by 9 unelected judges rather than the Canadian people acting through their representatives in Parliament. The Calgary School's influence reached far beyond the confines of the Ivory Tower. Morton was elected as Alberta's senator in waiting and later became an Alberta MLA. He subsequently took on several ministerial portfolios and unsuccessfully contested the 2006 and 2011 provincial progressive conservative leadership races. Flanagan helped develop the nascent Reform Party into an electorally viable political party during the 1990s. Stephen Harper, the man who would one day become prime minister, was also his protege. co-authoring with Harper an influential opinion piece that decried the state of Canadian conservatism and the dominance of the Liberals during the 1990s, Flanagan also managed his campaigns to become the leader of the Canadian Alliance and then the Reunited Conservative Party. More recently, Cooper caused a stir by contributing to the 2021 Free Alberta Strategy, a policy declaration that proposed an Alberta Sovereignty Act and the transfer of jurisdiction to the provincial government. True to form, these conservative intellectuals valued practical experience as much as theoretical understanding. From this first wave came a younger generation of scholars centered in the University of Guelph who have taken up the mantle of conservative legal scholarship. Morton and Knopf students Mark Harding, Dave Snow, Ian Brody, and Dennis Baker have continued the legacy of their mentors alongside Troy Riddell, chair of Guelph's political science department who studied under Manfredi, and Jeff Sigalet of UBC Okanagan. With greater comparative awareness and more rigorous methodologies, this second cohort has contributed to debates over constitutional exchanges between legislatures, executives, and courts, the role of Parliament in preserving rights, criminal justice policies, and the notwithstanding clause. For example, by comparing the strength and reach of rights documents in Canada, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, Harding's book Judicializing Everything assesses the extent to which constitutional values have penetrated public and private law. The overarching theme of this body of work has been to push back against assertions that courts are the final, sole interpreters of constitutional meaning. Like their predecessors, this influence extends into politics as well. Ian Brody was chief of staff in the Harper government from 2006 to 2008, executive director of the Conservative Party, and most recently the chair of the party's leadership election organizing committee during the 2022 leadership race. After his stint in politics, Brody published a book that, based on his experience at the center of government, challenges the long-standing centralization thesis which argues that the Prime Minister, by expanding the power of the Prime Minister's office and the Privy Council office, has aggrandized his executive authority at the expense of Canadian democracy. It bears mentioning that another one of Flanagan's scions, Danielle Smith, is currently the Premier of Alberta. This says nothing about the movement's countless other students who went on to successful careers in public policy, academia, and advocacy. For example, Manfredi also tutored a variety of now prominent voices in Canadian judicial politics like Sigalet, Riddell, Kate Pudister, James Kelly, Emmanuel Riches, Aaron Crandall, and Matthew Henegar. So impactful have these children of the Calgary School been on Canadian political life that Justice Malcolm Rowe, in his recent 2024 Runnymede Society keynote lecture, credited them for ushering in a Guelph School of Legal Analysis, the spiritual successor to the Calgary School. In his speech, Justice Rowe also argued forcefully that the realist analysis of the law by political scientists like Dave Snow, Mark Harding, and Peter Russell has often been more clear-sighted than the work of his fellow jurists and law professors. Composed of just a handful of individuals, the Calgary and now Guelph schools have pulled well above their weight in academic and real-world impact. With 8 out of its 25 faculty members specializing in law and politics, including its chair, a higher number in relative or absolute terms than any other political science department in the country, the University of Guelph is an emerging hub of research into legal studies, conservative or otherwise. Brian Sheldrick and Jordi Diaz teach about the intersection between the law and social movements, Pudister writes about criminal justice policy, and Min Do works on Indigenous judicial politics. Ironically, while conservative political scientists generally caution judicial restraint, many of their counterparts in the legal profession, such as the Canadian Constitution Foundation, are fighting in the courts to strike down the Trudeau government's laws on the basis of constitutional rights and jurisdictional overreach. They have done so successfully in cases like Canadian Frontline Nurses v. Canada, where the federal court ruled the use of the Emergencies Act unlawful. Reference Re-Impact Assessment Act, which found that environmental assessments of resource projects were outside Parliament's legislative authority, and the Toronto Council v. Ontario decision finding that it was constitutional for the Ford government to shrink the size of Toronto City Council. It seems Morton and Knopf's charter revolution has come full circle. Moreover, the Runnymede Society, a budding association of lawyers, professors, and students, promises to disrupt the legal landscape in Canada just as the Federalist Society has done so successfully in the United States. With student chapters at all major law schools and speeches by 3 Supreme Court justices, the Runnymede Society has a fighting chance of unsettling Canada's legal orthodoxy. The larger point is that, although much of the social sciences and humanities remain politically segregated with scholarship heavily skewed towards favoring a progressive ideological monoculture, this is not the case in the subfield of Canadian judicial politics. There you will find just as many critics of the judicialization of Canadian politics as supporters. Important debates continue to take place over whether the Supreme Court's jurisprudence favors the federal or provincial governments, how and why judges decide as they do, whether the courts and the legislature participate in a dialogue over the meaning of constitutional rights, and, most fundamentally, the appropriate role of courts and legislatures in a liberal democracy. The ideological orientation of participants spans the gamut, from critical legal theorists to straight-edge positivists to conservative skeptics. There might have been more left-wing critics of judicial supremacy in the past, but there still are some. We have the inheritance of intrepid academics like Rainer Knopf, Ted Morton, Christopher Manfredi, the recently retired Janet Hibbert, and most of all, the late Peter Russell to thank for the strength and diversity of Canadian judicial politics scholarship today. Regardless of one's political orientation, Russell, after all, identified as nonpartisan, that subfield's intellectual pluralism is an achievement worth celebrating.
That was a commentary by Charlie Buck. He is a PhD student at the University of Toronto studying Canadian politics with a particular interest in law, courts, and constitutionalism. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.